From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Trump is back at the White House today, beginning the new year with tweets about North Korea, Pakistan, and Iran, and talking about the Republican tax overhaul, which took effect yesterday. Now, the GOP may have ended last year on a high note, but Democrats are looking ahead to the fall when they hope to win big in this year's midterm election. So let's get the lay of the land from NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
Okay, so let's see how 2018 is starting off, because today the president repeated his support for anti-government protests in Iran, tweeting, quote, "The people of Iran are finally acting against the brutal and corrupt Iranian regime." But do we know, do we have any idea of what the administration's actual strategy is towards Iran right now?
We don't yet. And one Republican, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, went on television yesterday to say tweeting is not enough. The president needs a strategy. He has to lay out a plan to engage the regime. And he hasn't done that yet. There are a couple decisions he has to make pretty soon. Whether he's already decided to not recertify the Iran nuclear agreement, but he hasn't decided to ask Congress yet to put sanctions back on Iran. So that's one thing the White House could do. But of course, that doesn't really matter unless our European allies also decide to put sanctions on Iran. And the U.S. would have to engage in diplomacy to convince them to do that.
Right. Okay. So speaking of Congress, Congress also returns to Washington. The Senate returns tomorrow, the House next week. They'll get to work on negotiating another spending bill in order to keep the government open beyond January 19th. But there seems to be a battle there over the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program as well.
That's true. Tomorrow, Mark Short, who's the legislative affairs director at the White House, and Mick Mulvaney, who's head of the budget office, are going to go up to Capitol Hill and meet with the bipartisan bicameral leadership. And they're going to try to figure out what kind of budget caps they're willing to agree to so the government can stay open beyond January 19th. You're right, DACA, what to do with all those kids who were brought here illegally as children, and Obama gave them deportation relief. Trump removed it and gave Congress a deadline of March to restore deportation relief to them if that's what Congress wants to do. I don't know if that's going to be part of this end of January funding deal. They might decide to let it go all the way up until the deadline that the president has imposed of March. But there's no doubt that the Democrats feel very strongly about this. The president has said he'd only make a DACA deal if he got funding for the wall, which is a non-starter with Democrats. So the question is there some kind of a compromise that would include language that Trump could say was funding for the wall and Democrats could say was not funding for the wall?
Just got a minute here to go, Mara. I mean, we could talk about lots of things that Congress wants to do, including infrastructure, which is interesting. But, you know, in the introduction, I mentioned that Democrats hope to have some kind of blue wave in November of this year. Now, 11 months is an eternity in politics. I completely understand that. But is there any legitimacy to that hope?
I think there's a legitimacy to some kind of a wave, whether it would be big enough to get them the House back or to mitigate their losses in the Senate is unclear. The rule of thumb is that because of the way that Republicans are fortified by redistricting, Democrats would have to win 58% of the national vote for the House of Representatives just to get 50% of the seats. That's a very high bar. The generic ballot is not that big yet for Democrats, even though they have an advantage, but they'd need about a 16-point advantage to get over those kind of structural fortifications for Republicans. So I think that Democrats are very optimistic. There's a lot of talk about a big wave. It's kind of like take the House back or bust. Yeah. I think expectations are high, and I also think that they've maybe put the bar too high.
Yeah. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, now we want to note the passing of Erica Garner, the 27-year-old daughter of Eric Garner, whose last words were, "I can't breathe," after he was held in a chokehold by a New York City police officer.
I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe.
After her father's death 4 years ago, Erica became an outspoken activist for police reform. Like her father, Erica had asthma, and last week an asthma attack prompted a massive heart attack from which she never recovered. Deray McKesson is the Baltimore activist who's become a leading voice in the Black Lives Matter movement and knew well Erica's work. Deray, many mourning her loss, her family, her children. But tell us what she was to the Black Lives Matter movement.
You know, it was clear from the moment that her father was killed and there wasn't a guilty verdict or charges that were sustained against the officer who killed Eric Garner, she became a tireless advocate. And what I can say about all of my experiences with Erica, either seeing her on TV or on social media or in person, that she took the truth with her everywhere, that she made sure that she was going to be a truth teller, whether it was to the mayor, the president, to the news, to the public. And you remember right after Eric Garner was killed, she did those weekly protests in Staten Island, and she did it whether two people showed up or 200 people showed up because she wanted to make a point about remembering his life.
And you're referring to Erica going to the spot, the same street corner where her father was put in a chokehold on Staten Island, and she would stage a die-in. She would lie there and protest 2 days a week. You mentioned she wasn't afraid to call out Mayor de Blasio, mayor of New York, or President Obama or Hillary Clinton if she felt they didn't follow through on policy. She criticized de Blasio for not fully ending the controversial stop and frisk policy that a federal judge ruled disproportionately targeted African Americans. This is something he campaigned against, the policy, when running. Talk about those moments when she would take on these figures who wanted to be seen as aligned with her.
Yeah, I think that that is one of the most enduring legacies that she will have for activists across the country and people who are just committed to justice, as she showed that we have to take the truth with us into every room, that the fear of being silenced like can't stop us from telling the truth, and she did that. So, you know, that's one of the things that I'll take with me when I think about her. The other thing that her death reminds us all about is the maternal mortality of Black women. You know, she had a heart attack when she gave birth to her son. This is the second heart attack she had, as it's been reported. You know, Black women have the highest maternal mortality of any population in the country. And that is not only due to the lack of access to high quality health care, but it's also due to the incredible impact of stress. And the stress in Erica Garner's life was monumental, not only because of the circumstances of her father's death and her work in activism, but also because of the institutional racism that she just experienced as a Black woman in this country. So I'm hopeful that people will start to talk about these things more so that we can get to a place to think about solutions.
Well, you know, we were struck by the fact that she had asthma, contributed directly to her heart attack. Her father had asthma, contributed to his death. You know, he truly could not breathe. And then you add a chokehold to that. And asthma disproportionately affects people in low-income areas in the inner cities. She did an interview last month with Katie Halper of New York Magazine speaking about her father. Let's listen to a little of that.
He was the type of guy, he was a family man. He did everything that he could to take care of his six kids. He never really had any type of altercation. He was like a gentle giant. Like, he loved his neighborhood. He loved his family. But my father was like, you know, he was like my hero.
DeRay McKesson, we read in Matt Taibbi's terrific book, I Can't Breathe, which is really more about the Garner family than that one incident, how Erica as a child was instrumental in demanding that her father get on a straighter path. We just heard her say he'd do anything for his family, and he was trying to support his kids when he fell into selling drugs. After that intervention from his children, that's when he turned to selling loose cigarettes, the loosies he was selling when he was confronted by police, thought it was more of a straight and narrow thing to do. Talk about how she related to her father.
In all of the interviews that I've seen, and like that one that you played the clip of, is that she was really insistent on reminding people that her father was a nice, ordinary person, that while he might have made mistakes, he should be alive, that death was not the consequence of any of the mistakes that he made, and that we all make mistakes, right? That we aren't perfect people, none of us are. But that when Black men and Black women and Black trans members of our community make mistakes, that the consequence is often much more severe than other people in the community. And she was really clear about that. And I think that that comes across in so many of her conversations, that she helped to remind us of the humanity of this work and of the impact of it. And I think that that has not gone forgotten.
Well, and Matt Taibbi, again, in the book, I Can't Breathe, which I highly recommend, reminded us that, you know, bartenders in fancy bars in downtown New York sold loosies to their customers. Nobody bothered them. Here was a Black man selling them on a street corner, confronted by police.
We all saw that video. Like, why did it take so many officers to engage him for loosies, right? Like, that is, there's nothing about that that makes sense. And I think that Erica wanted us to be confronted with that every time we thought about her father's case. And nothing about that made sense at all. Nothing about a chokehold made sense at all for what he was suspected of doing.
Look, Erica was starting a nonprofit to focus on organizing and endorsing candidates. Is that someone picking up that work, do you know?
I think that people all across the country are. You know, she endorsed and supported Bernie Sanders. I think that she helped show so many people that we have to be involved at every level, that it is about being in the streets. It's about being at the boardroom. It's about being on committees. It's about being at the ballot box, too. And I think that she helped people realize that systems and structures have to change. And if all we've done is change the conversation, that is not yet the win.
That's DeRay McKesson, a leading voice in the Black Lives Matter movement, helping us remember another voice, Erica Garner Stilled, this 27-year-old mother, but also daughter of Eric Garner, recently died after a heart attack. DeRay, thank you.
Thank you.
In the opening seconds of Jennifer Brea's stunning new documentary, we hear her grunting, then slowly see her dragging herself across the floor with the camera she's using to film herself.
Oh, God.
Stop!
Later, she's in a wheelchair, struck by piercing pain. Her attentive husband, Omar Wasso, struggles to help her, but she can't speak.
I can't understand, love.
Jen Brea was a Harvard PhD candidate and vibrant world traveler who now couldn't get out of bed. It took a year and a half to find a doctor who realized she had the neuroimmune condition myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME, or chronic fatigue syndrome. From her bed, through her laptop, she recorded some of the millions of other ME sufferers around the world, and doctors like Nancy Klimas of Miami's Veterans Administration.
Inside every cell, there's your energy-making machine. It's called a mitochondria. So in this illness, each individual cell can have real problems capturing the things they need that your body uses to make energy, like oxygen and glucose. At a cellular level, you become less and less effective, like a wound-down clock.
Jennifer Brea's film is Unrest. It will be shown on PBS next Monday, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Tell us what this is.
This is a disease that I had never even heard of. Frequently, you get sick, usually after an infection, and then you can spend anywhere from several months to 5 years or more trying to find a diagnosis. Many patients are disbelieved that they're even sick at all. And so, so many of us have gone online to try to find each other.
This is something that is historical, that women have been told they're hysterical.
Well, I think the core challenge is that very few medical schools even have this as part of their curriculum. When a patient comes in with the symptoms that I had, they don't know how to diagnose you. They can start to blame you. You know, patients can have a number of different symptoms, but the core symptoms we all share is something called post-exertional malaise, or PEM. And this basically means that when we exert ourselves either physically or mentally past a certain limit, we crash and all of our symptoms get worse. And what they're starting to find now in kind of laboratory studies is that it's because we have this very low threshold of kind of aerobic energy. So you can imagine an athlete when they're running really hard, they will start to get kind of lactic acid in their muscles and they'll start to feel achy. And that can happen to someone like me if I just stand up and walk across the room. You know, some patients are mildly affected, so they may hit their limit working full time and have to spend the weekends in bed to recover. For someone who's very severe, it might even be too much effort to be able to feed themselves or even get out of bed at all.
Yeah. Then in the 80s, there was an outbreak in Incline Village, Nevada. They thought it was an outbreak of mononucleosis on a girls' basketball team.
There have actually been about 70 outbreaks documented in medical journals, the largest of which was in Incline Village, Nevada. And when the CDC came out to investigate and ended up deciding that, you know, it was probably a case of mass hysteria, you know, out of the 80s, we had this sort of horrible name, chronic fatigue syndrome, which I think has really served to obscure the reality of this disease. is a disease that is twice as common as multiple sclerosis and, you know, on average can be even more debilitating. And yet we get almost no research funding and no access to medical care.
Well, but as you said, you have access to each other. Let's listen. There's a sort of a montage of people from around the world talking about this.
Yeah, I'm completely bedridden. I've lost the ability to walk.
I crawl from my bed to my bathroom and I just think, this is my life. What?
It's the cognitive problems that are the most disabling.
I live in a dark room 24/7.
How much did that help to connect with other people with ME?
It was everything. You know, as I was getting sicker and sicker and didn't know what was happening to me, I was really scared. And I also didn't know how I was going to survive it because I knew that there are people who, you know, are never able to get well enough to leave their bedrooms again. And I needed to, you know, on the one hand, keep fighting to get better and keep searching for treatments. And at the same time, try to accept the fact that maybe I would never improve. And if I didn't, what meaning could my life have? And I think in that community, I came to learn that it is still possible to be a person, to be a human being.
Well, I was so touched by Jessica. She has the bones of a 100-year-old, completely debilitated.
I remember my 16th birthday in bed and remember my 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th. 21st.
You also meet Ron Davis, who is professor of biochemistry and genetics and director of the Stanford Genome Technology Center at Stanford. He's working with, you know, Nobel laureates. They're frustrated because they can't get their research peer-reviewed and they can't get funding from the government. And in his case, it just becomes heartbreaking because his son Whitney is so debilitated by ME, he can't even eat. Here's Dr. Davis.
I'm working against the clock. How much time does he have? When I get to the point where some of his organs start shutting down or something like that, I worry about that.
I mean, just, it does remind me of the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. Families had these children in back rooms that they were trying to help. And that's what this reminds me of. Are we any closer to a cure, to something to relieve this?
I mean, I think it's been really hard for me to, I'm sorry, hang on 1 second.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, the way you framed the question was so perceptive that I'm a little bit hit by it, but in a good way. I think it's absolutely analogous to the early days of HIV. I mean, these are very different epidemics. This one doesn't always kill, but can kill. But it's invisible, and so very, very hard to see. And so we do have literally millions of people around the world who are hidden in their homes and bedrooms. And I think the thing that is so heartbreaking to me is looking back at all of the decades that were lost and wasted, not believing patients, not trying to find an answer. I think the good news is that now there are more labs working on researching this disease. There are labs at UCSD, Columbia, Harvard, Cornell. The challenge is that the funding, the investment that the National Institute of Health is putting into this disease is still not remotely commensurate to the scientific interest and just how many people are affected and how debilitating the disease is. But I think the thing that gives me the most hope is that we now know so much more about a wide variety of infectious and autoimmune conditions from the last 30 years of investment in those diseases. And so because of that, there are already drugs on the market. I'm taking some of them, actually, that could benefit patients if we were able to do large-scale trials and give people access.
One way to see the impact of this, obviously we see you throughout the film, and you're very brave. I mean, you just put yourself out there. But we also watch your husband, Omar Wasso, well-known in several circles for BlackPlanet.com, the social media website for African Americans. He's one of the leading voices for a long time on the use of social media. Let's listen to a scene when he breaks down, you know, what it's like to stand next to somebody and have to watch them go through this. Let's listen.
You know what it is? It's that people feel sorry for me. And I don't know why that.
Baby, I'm so sorry.
It's a nerve.
I think the hardest thing for me about living with this disease was actually watching Omar and what he was going through. When we got married, we thought that, you know, in sickness and in health would mean, you know, when we're 80, and our, you know, when our, and that we wouldn't sort of be facing those questions at the beginning of our lives together. It is really hard for him because for a very long time, you know, he was my caretaker, just cooking and cleaning and taking care of me and sitting by my bed and holding my hand when I was in an extraordinary amount of pain. And I think the hardest thing for him was that helplessness. And I think the thing that we always wonder about is what happens to all of those people who don't have someone to care for them, you know, and I've heard so many stories of people who just disappear, who either commit suicide or end up homeless because of this.
There's one part of the film where, again, you're talking to people from around the world and they swear they have found the cure.
I have the cure to motherfucking chronic fatigue.
I cured my chronic fatigue with a high-carb vegan diet.
Started eating the good foods, the whole foods.
Two dietary supplements, they can really, really help.
Omar and I took this approach where, you know, we were willing to try anything that could potentially help and was unlikely to harm just to see if it would work. 10 or 20 things, you find one thing that actually truly does help. And, you know, I'm really lucky to say today that, you know, I am no longer bedridden. I'm still profoundly affected and I need to use a wheelchair to leave my house, but I can go outside in the world and travel and do some of the things that I used to love. And that really has been through this very slow process of, you know, self-experimentation, you know, and also working with doctors and really putting together those pieces of a protocol over a long period of time.
And pushing for funding for a cure.
Yeah, and pushing for funding for a cure. There's still so much work to be done.
That's Jennifer Brea. Her documentary about the neuroimmune condition ME, or chronic fatigue syndrome, is called Unrest. It will air on PBS next Monday. Jen, thank you and best of luck.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And again, after you see this film, you will never call it just fatigue again. The film Unrest, directed and produced by Jennifer Brea, after her GoFundMe campaign. What has MECFS meant to you? Let us know. HereAndNow.org. Anti-government protests in Iran that began last Thursday have claimed more than 20 lives. And as we've been hearing, they began in part because of rising prices on basic goods, alleged corruption, inequity. Iran has experienced some economic gains since the nuclear deal it signed with the U.S. and other world powers in 2015, which eased sanctions on the country and unfroze assets. But that's not trickling down. We want to go a little deeper now with Robin Farzad, who's host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Hi, Robin.
Robin, how are you?
Okay, we could do that all day. I call each other Robin, but we go on. Borzu Dargahi was on the other day, and he told us that Tehranians are pouring into Turkey, where he is, with money to spend, that there is economic growth in Iran. Inflation has been falling. So go a little deeper. Why is the economy one of the reasons for these protests?
You know, I like to joke if I showed up in Tehran with a box full of unlocked iPhone 10s, I'd make out like a bandit. I mean, or open the first Chipotle in Tehran. And that kind of speaks to all the high expectations that were baked into that sanctions relief under Obama and Secretary Kerry. Mom and pop Iranians, they were expecting a windfall, job opportunities, and a trickle down of government revenue. And that's largely not played out. And on top of that, you have high prices, still stubbornly high prices, and joblessness at about 25% for those who are 30 and under. So something has to give.
Right. And we're reading oil production up above the pre-sanction levels now. Oil, an important factor in Iran's economy. But is it part of the same idea that it's, you know, there's a group making money maybe from oil production, but it's not trickling down?
That is a big problem. This economy is still overwhelmingly and disproportionately dependent on oil revenue. There was hope that the Rouhani presidency would do a better job parlaying that into a more diversified economy. But at the same time, the price of oil has tanked over the past 4 years. It's still up a little bit. But it's been for the government about trying to do less with less. And people are unhappy. And you're seeing a race to cut subsidies and people pushing back.
Yeah. Well, and that's in some ways what we're describing is not unlike what happened in the United States. I mean, we have a huge inequity, you know, a difference in wages, for instance, here in this country. And that was said to propel voters to the polls for President Trump. But what's the sense of what happens in Iran?
You know, the government's scrambling to try to balance its books, and that's, you know, separate all of that from the political and ideological realm. But that includes a proposal to slash subsidies on basic goods. You're talking food, services for the poor. People in Iran feel entitled to cheap gasoline, but some are seeing prices up by about 50%. And so Iranians, even supporters of the revolutionary regime, are rethinking that original social compact, that this is about redistribution of wealth and you know, stepping away from the monarchy and the abuses of the 1970s. And when that hasn't played out, many who have never taken to the streets are going to resort to that.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Goldman Sachs names a number of countries that have the potential for significant economic growth. It's called the Next 11. And Iran is on that list. You know, we've been describing a shaky situation now, but why would they have great prospects?
I mean, go figure. That's the central paradox. This is an overwhelmingly literate, young and restless population of more than 80 million that was a mainstream market, you know, emerging market just 40 years ago. Even Harvard Business School had a satellite program in Tehran, and all that was hugely interrupted by the revolution. People have not seen gains in their standard of living, and some who are still old enough to remember the revolution are nostalgic for an old economic ability that they had.
We're going to take up this again. It's great. Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Thank you.
Happy New Year. Thank you.
You too.
The Winter Olympics could play a role in easing tensions on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea is proposing negotiations with the North next week. That offer came in response to what Kim Jong-un said in his New Year's Day speech. The North Korean leader said he would consider sending a delegation to the Winter Olympics in South Korea next month. But that conciliatory note came in a speech that also included this message for President Trump. Kim here is speaking through an interpreter.
The entire continent of America is within reach of our nuclear attack. They must never forget the nuclear button is placed on my desk at all times.
Retired Admiral James Stavridis is dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's also former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe. He joins us now. Admiral Stavridis, welcome back.
Always great to be with you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Starts off with a bang, if I could say. What do you make of these two messages from North Korea?
Well, first of all, I'm just trying to picture that big red button on his desk. But I assure you, he does not have the capability at this moment to use an intercontinental ballistic missile with a nuclear weapon to reach the continental United States. He is certainly moving in that direction. But let's focus on the positive here.
Yeah.
And that is a real opening, and we ought to seize it. And the United States and China could have a role to play. We could expand this to four-party talks. But let's start small. Let the two Koreas have the conversation and hope diplomacy prevails.
Well, so let me ask you about that, because has the United States, through its own belligerent language over the past year regarding North Korea, sort of compromised its potential efficacy if indeed there are talks between the North and the South? Do either Koreas want the U.S. involved?
I'd say at this moment, probably not. And I would say that we have compromised our ability, but we haven't fatally ended it. And I think there's still time for the United States to play a positive diplomatic role here. And this gets us into the discombobulation in the Trump administration, where we have the president tweeting, talking about diplomacy won't work, and yet we have a secretary of state saying, of course we need to try diplomacy, and a secretary of defense somewhere in the middle. The administration has to get its messaging straight. If it does, we have a role to play here.
Okay, so let's play another piece of tape here to get your response. This is Admiral Mike Mullen, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was on ABC's This Week on Sunday. Let's listen to what he said.
We're actually closer, in my view, to a nuclear war with North Korea and in that region than we've ever been. And I just don't see the opportunities to solve this diplomatically at this particular point.
He seems to be disagreeing with you there, Admiral Stavridis. Your thoughts?
I disagree with his view that we do not have a diplomatic option here. I will say this. I agree that we are closer to a war than we have been, certainly in my career, stretching back four decades. I'd say the chances of a full-on war are about 20%. But I think there's still a 70, 80% chance that diplomacy can work this thing out. And we ought to, again, seize on this tiny opening we're seeing from Kim Jong-un.
Admiral, to be perfectly honest, it kind of sends a chill through my spine to hear you say that the chance of a full-on war is as high as 20%.
It should, because it would result in casualties in the 2 to 4 million range, because it's hard to imagine a war that begins that does not involve a nuclear exchange on the Korean Peninsula. Kim Jong-un, if his regime is threatened, and he would lose this war, but his last act will be to unleash those nuclear weapons. So we've got to avoid that outcome. I think there are still diplomatic options to play, and we ought to move with this small opening as aggressively as we can.
So that said, Admiral, I mean, it sort of returns us to your earlier point about the vital importance of the Trump administration sort of aligning its message, right, in this moment. But, I mean, do we really know, or what do we know about what the commander-in-chief, what the president actually wants?
Well, we have certainly his tweet storms on display, but let us hope that the cadre around him, General John Kelly, Chief of Staff, General Jim Mattis over in the Pentagon, Secretary of State Tillerson, will move him off of this aggressive rhetoric and move us toward openings. Meanwhile, what we should be doing is increasing our intelligence, working closely with our South Korean partners to learn more about what's really happening in the North, increasing our missile defense, upping our cyber options. We have a lot we can do, and I would throw into the mix, Meghna, a maritime interception operation to really enforce this new round of sanctions. All of those are measures short of war that we ought to be pursuing.
Huh. Well, let's turn to the protests in Iran while we have you, Admiral Stavridis, because Iran's supreme leader today blamed demonstrations on, quote, Iran's enemies. He didn't name the United States, but, of course, President Trump has tweeted that Iran is failing at every level. You know, what should be the U.S.'s take or posture on Iran right now?
Well, the protests, I would say, represent both an opportunity and a danger. The opportunity is that if we play our hand of cards well and are relatively in the background on this, there is a real chance here of exchanging the regime in Tehran. On the other hand, the danger is if we get too aggressive, we'll make the story not about the protest, but about us as the great Satan. We'll become a rallying cry within Iran, and that would be disastrous and would set back the possibilities of a real regime change. So my argument is, yes, let's be involved in this. Let's, however, do it through our allies. Let's work through the Saudis, the Jordanians, but overtly pounding the table and calling out the regime at this minute is going to lead to an explosive turn within the country against the United States, and that will hurt this resistance. So we have to play our cards very carefully.
So how do we read the president's, people can say what they want about the tweets, but how do we read President Trump's tweets, which are expressing some sympathy for Iranian protesters? While at the same time, I mean, we have this travel ban that the Supreme Court has approved, putting Iran's on that list. Iranian people can't even come here. I mean, again, I'm just thinking big picture. Do the United States continue to hobble itself diplomatically regarding its influence in these moments with domestic decisions that the Trump administration has made or not?
We absolutely do. And let's face it, the Uber story in all of this, North Korea, Iran, the Islamic State, what happens in Syria, how to confront Russia for intrusion in our election, the Uber story here is the United States withdrawing from positions of leadership around the world so that when we do have an opportunity like we do at the moment in Tehran or a diplomatic opportunity in North Korea, we have reduced our own ability to engage, not only with our domestic policies, as you correctly point out, Meghna, but also our overt sense of withdrawal, say from the climate agreement or from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. all of these are signals to the world that the United States doesn't want to lead. Then when we have an opportunity like this, we have much less ability to engage.
The entire post-war consensus around geopolitical stability has presumed American leadership. If you're saying that that's not there anymore, who's going to fill the void?
I have one word for you, and it's China. The most important speech of 2017 was not made in Washington, D.C. It was made in Beijing by Xi Jinping, the leader of China, talking about now is the time for China's emergence as a global power. And that doesn't mean the United States and China must go to war or will go to war, but it means we have serious competition in the world, and our value system, democracy, liberty, freedom of speech, human rights, gender equality, we execute it imperfectly, but it's the right set of values. And we will be challenged by a very different system from China. They are willing, ready, and able to step into these leadership voids we are creating.
Well, James Stavridis is Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's also former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Admiral Stavridis, it's always rather bracing to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Meghna. Talk soon.
The number of homeless students in the U.S. is growing. In the 2015-2016 school year, there were more than 1.3 million homeless kids in schools. That's more than double the number from just about a decade ago. Federal law requires school districts to identify these kids, offer them resources, and make it as easy as possible for them to get to school. But as Lee Romney from member station KALW reports from Oakland, California, the funding does not come close to meeting the needs of homeless students.
Just 10-year-old Nassim Bennett is getting ready for school. The fifth grader can't find his bubblegum toothpaste, so he has to use the adult stuff.
That really stings the mouth.
It sounds like a typical domestic scene, but this isn't Nassim's house. He and his mom, Raquel Allenby, are sleeping in his great-grandmother's living room.
Is this where you sleep?
Nassim sleeps on an air mattress, his mother on the couch, and they get up really early. That's because Nassim's school is 22 miles and three counties away. For years, Raquel and Nassim lived in Oakland with Mr. Spooky the Cat and Cujo the Chihuahua. When Nassim was in fourth grade, they got evicted from their apartment. Raquel says wrongfully. It's hard for her to use the word, but about a year ago, they became homeless.
Nassim is the main one that I worry about because I know when he's stressed out.
The National Center for Homeless Education reports that students who lose their housing, even briefly, perform more poorly in school. They're often late or miss days. They're less likely than any other group to graduate. Nassim's had anxiety attacks, temper tantrums, lots of stress eating. After they were evicted, he and his mom had no choice but to come here to his great-grandma's one-bedroom apartment near a leafy park in South San Francisco.
And then traveling from here all the way to Oakland, and then go Oakland, and then back here.
The back and forth? That's so Nassim can stay in the same school where he's been since kindergarten, where they know him and care about him.
Oh, where are my Pokemon cards?
The whole trip takes nearly 2 hours. Keeping Nassim in the same school is actually Raquel's legal right. 3 decades ago, President Ronald Reagan signed the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act into federal law. The idea is to provide stability for homeless children. The law guarantees that students who've lost their fixed housing can stay at the school they've been attending. It guarantees other rights, too, like help with transportation costs to and from school. Raquel and Nassim could really use that.
What's this say, 340?
Does it have B on it?
The bulk of their commute is a long ride on Bay Area Rapid Transit, or BART. Nassim has plenty of company. His school district, Oakland Unified, saw an increase of more than 50% in its homeless student tally last year to almost 1,600 kids. This is Trish Anderson, Oakland Unified's McKinney-Vento liaison.
So when you think about the number of people in that situation in Oakland right now with the housing crisis, that number is bound to be larger than it was in the past, in previous years.
The law says districts have to work with schools to identify students who've lost their housing. They're supposed to spread the word at soup kitchens and shelters and motels so families know what they're entitled to. Staying in their home school, enrolling without proof of an address, getting transportation help, and additional supports like referrals to housing. But there's a gap between what the law promises and what it delivers. Oakland Unified's funding has stayed flat for the past 3 years.
Okay, thank you everybody. So we are going to begin by dismissing from the sides with Ms. Thomas's class and Ms. Chandler's class. Go ahead on in.
In class, Nassim puts his head on his desk. His teacher, Miss Grill, leans down close to check in.
How are you doing, Nassim?
I don't know.
You don't know? Is today feeling a little hard, the first day back at school? You're hungry? Well, why don't you eat an apple or some yogurt?
New changes to the federal law that went into effect in late 2016 call for more training for school personnel so that homeless students are flagged and plugged into support. But Oakland Unified's budget is bare bones. Anderson spends a lot of time hunting for private donations. As for those regional commuter train tickets that Nassim and his mom need, the district doesn't provide them. Anderson says even funding for local bus passes doesn't stretch.
Around April, we're running out of funding for transportation.
Back in South San Francisco, after a 14-hour day, Raquel and Nassim are exhausted. Raquel says she loves to dream about the home she'll share with her son again one day. But Nassim doesn't want to play that game.
But do you want your own room again one day?
Yeah.
What do you miss about that? You don't want to say, huh?
They spent the whole fall semester having conversations like this and struggling to get Nassim to school on time. But just a few weeks ago, they got lucky. Raquel found a studio apartment in Oakland. She says making the rent won't be easy on her janitor's pay. But she and Nassim will now have their privacy, and he'll get more sleep, which will help him at school. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Romney in Oakland.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.